Blog Talk Radio.
If you find yourself in trouble, count on me, my friend. I'll get right up in trouble's face. You won't see him again. I've got the backbone, American. I've got the heart, American. I've got the will, American. Will you stand up, don't sit down? Stand up, don't back down. Stand up, shout it out. Stand up, let's make it loud. American, American.
Welcome to another exciting show with Southern Sense on Blog Talk Radio. So turn up the volume and enter our chat room, or grab your phones, call in, and join the conversation. Help us to restore the republic to this country and inspire the majority to be silent no longer.
Well, look me straight in the eye. Tell me what you see. I'll tell the truth every time, yes, you can count on me. I've got the backbone, American. I've got the heart, American. I've got the will, American. Will you stand up, don't sit down? Stand up, don't back down. Stand up and shout it out. Stand up, let's make it loud. American, 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 American.
Good afternoon to another exciting adventure of Southern Sense on Blog Talk Radio. I'm your hostess with the mostest, the radio chick, along with my handsome, suave, sophisticated, and oh-so-skinny, cool Mike. Good afternoon, Mikey.
Hello, Annie. Thank you for that beautiful introduction. Great to be here on this 25th of January.
Yep, and we have a great guest coming up. He's a stand-up comedian and a writer, and he was actually the genius behind some of Bill Maher when Bill Maher wasn't busy bashing conservatives. He is a conservative and has the longest-running conservative comedy show running in Los Angeles, Evan Sayette. He'll be joining us at quarter after the hour.
Awesome. And we're looking very forward to it. And also, of course, we see Darianne and Jermaine and Jules in the chat room. I don't know. All my friends said they were coming. I haven't seen one of them.
Well, they're always late to the party. What do you expect?
Or
what do you expect? Yeah. Well, we've got a special dedication today, and this happens to be someone that I knew, a friend of mine. And what happened to him and his family was devastating. So everyone that does listen knows that every show is started off with a dedication to a fallen hero. We don't have any music to put behind this because this is for a New York City police officer. And we will begin the dedication. Is that all right with you, Mike?
Absolutely. Let's play some. Okay, go ahead.
We can probably play the Colonial Military mix. I guess that would go with the New York City. All right, we'll go with that one. And this goes to Officer Robert Machado, who was killed in the line of duty in Brooklyn South, New York City, on March 3rd, 1989. And I was on duty that day. I did a day tour, but this occurred later in the afternoon after I had already gone home. And this is in several different parts, so just bear with me. Plainclothes officer Robert Machete was fatally shot in the Flatbush section of Brooklyn. Machete was shot after he and his partner, Gustavo Cecini, approached a group of men who appeared to be having a dispute on East 23rd Street off Newkirk Avenue. Police said a struggle ensued between Reynaldo Rayside and Robert Machete. The police said Rayside grabbed the gun of Officer Machete, his .38 caliber, during the struggle and shot Machete once in the abdomen. Actually, he was shot in the back and the bullet exited through his thoracic cavity. Arrested were Reynaldo Rayside, 23, of Crown Heights, and Kirk Hennepath, 22, of Flatbush. Rayside was charged with first and second degree attempted murder, first degree robbery, grand larceny, escape, and felony weapons possession. Kirk Hennepath, who was with Reynaldo Rayside when the shooting occurred, made a statement implicating Rayside as the gunman. Hennepath was charged with felony assault of a police officer and possession of a weapon. A Brooklyn jury acquitted Reynaldo Rayside of murder in the slaying of police officer Robert Machete. Robert Machete was only 25 years old. He joined the force on July 15, 1986, the same day I joined the police force. He had received 2 commendations and 11 awards for excellent police duty. Both commendations, as well as the 5 he had pending, were for gun-related arrests. A 26-year-old former convict who was charged with killing a police officer on a Brooklyn street last year was acquitted of murder. The suspect, Reynaldo Rayside, was an illegal alien from Panama and had been charged with first and second degree murder for the March 3, 1989 slaying of Officer Robert E. Machete. Was working on a robbery detail in the Flatbush section when he was fatally shot. While acquitting Mr. Rayside of murder, the 12-member grand jury found him guilty of 2 lesser crimes, second-degree escape and third-degree criminal possession of a weapon. The jury deliberated for 10 hours over 2 days. Mr. Rayside faces 3 to 7 years in prison on each count. He was sentenced by Justice Ronald J. Alito of the State Supreme Court in Brooklyn. He will serve only a maximum of 11 years. And this sentence was executed on the 1990, so he is already out. Well, his mother screamed, "No, no, no," when the verdict was read. Members of Officer Machete's family were in the courtroom when the jury delivered its verdict shortly after 7 p.m. We asked the slain officer's mother, and his brother Thomas, who was also a police officer, jumped to his feet in the back of the courtroom and shouted, "No, no, no. I can't believe this is happening." He was restrained by supporters of the Machete family, who quickly led him from the courtroom. The prosecution had argued that Machete, his partner, Gustavo Cecini, stopped Mr. Rayside and another man, Kurt Kenneth, to question Mr. Rayside's vessel, which walked to Machete, took the 38 caliber pistol and shot him. The defense lawyer, Joseph Giannani, argued that Machete was not shot by Mr. Rayside, but by a shot fired by another police officer, possibly Officer Cecini. Officer Machete, whose gun never recovered, was killed by a bullet that entered his lower back and lodged in his chest. This means nothing. Mr. Giannini attributed the jury's decision on the murder charge to what he called inconsistencies in the prosecution's case during the 3-week trial. There were comments placed on a webpage that New York City Police Department has for fallen angels. Faithful unto death, it is titled. One of the comments reads from Detective Jim Danello. While assigned to the King's Warrant Squad, I was assigned a number of warrants on arrests that Bob made. He always included extra information on the perp and a warning to be careful, he's a bad guy, when he felt it was appropriate. A nice touch from a good cop. I pray he's resting in peace. And this is from Scott Britton. Great man with a large heart. I remember growing up on his block in Brooklyn. I remember a good-hearted guy who taught me how to box to stay out of trouble. I remember Robert looking out for all and taking after his father. I remember his family. I remember Robert Scotty. Thank you. I will never forget. My prayers go out to all the Scotty family, and may God bless him and rest in peace. I will never forget. This is from Ed McLaughlin, retired from the 6-0. I was an uncle to Robert Jr., his sister and brother. I would sit in the kitchen with Bob Sr. telling war stories. Bob Jr. said I was an inspiration and he wanted to be like me. I pray that I wasn't the one that led him into the life he chose, which led to his death. Robert Jr. was a good cop, better than I could ever hope to be. And this is from Anthony Sacomanjo. I just found the site, but would like to say Bobby was a good friend of mine. He was a great cop in person. I will never forget you, my friend, or all the good times we had. Bob had a heart as big as he was, and he would help out anyone he could. God bless you, Robert. I could go on. I knew Robert Machete. He was a friend of mine. I was a board officer for the Columbia Association, which represented the Italian-American cops in New York City Police Department. His father was a member, and he was a member. And the Columbia Association every year awards a scholarship in memory of Robert Machete. It has been 14 years, and I still remember him. This goes out to him and all our heroes, today and every day, that serve and protect our nation. God bless. This is My Name is America by Todd Allen Herndon.
Born in the grip of oppression, I fought for my liberty. I paid with the blood of my people. Freedom has never been free. Now my door's always open to dreamers and friends. When I'm attacked, I protect and defend. Because my name is America, I stand proud and free. My name is America, don't tread on me. I cannot be broken, I cannot be shamed. If you hurt me, I'll get stronger, and I'll rise up from the fire. Others gave it to me. They believe in the virtues I stand for, my respect for humanity. Now I'm challenged by tyrants who envy my power, but their vicious deeds become my finest hour. Because my name, I stand proud and free. My name is America, don't tread on me. I cannot be broken, I cannot be shamed. If you hurt me, I'll get stronger, and I'll rise up.
is America by Todd Allen Herndon. And I do apologize to everyone for my cracking up a little bit when I was reading that dedication. It's been 24 years. I said 14, but it's been 24 years since my friend Robert Musciati was gunned down on that street in Brooklyn. And it still tears me up. I think of him and his family. And matter of fact, got a little story. I came back from the South Carolina Tea Party Convention just earlier this month. And, you know, retired cop, your ears pick up and you hear things. And I heard someone speaking about illegal immigrants to someone else. And he was talking about having helped to deport someone by the name of Reynaldo Rayside. And all of a sudden I popped up because I remember that name. And I walked over and I talked to him. And his name happens to be Mike Cutler. And he will be a guest later on the show. But he was the INS agent who, back in 1986, escorted him onto the airplane and had him deported for being an illegal alien and for prior criminal convictions for robbery. This man then, this illegal alien, snuck back into the country and then just a few short years later gunned down my friend on the street. So it's amazing how it is a small world, how things just come around. But we've got a fantastic guest. I don't want to get everyone depressed. So hopefully he'll help put us a smile
back
on the face.
Before you bring the guest, I have a question for you.
Sure.
How did the Supreme Court judge get involved in this? Wouldn't a local, because you said South Brooklyn, wouldn't like a Brooklyn court handle that? You mentioned
he was in a Brooklyn court. I do believe I said it was a Brooklyn judge. But it was Brooklyn Supreme Court,
which
is the New York State Court.
Oh, okay. All right. I didn't realize that's what they call it. Okay.
All right. Well, we have a fantastic guest. He's a comedian, also a writer. He's got a great book out, which I finally finished it last night without any interruption. It's called The Kindergarten of Eden, How the Modern Liberal Thinks and Why He's Convinced That He Can Exist. We welcome aboard Evan Sayed. Good afternoon, Evan. How are you this morning?
I am well. Thanks, Anne. How are you?
Okay. All right. As I told you before, we start off each show with a dedication to a fallen hero. And it was ironic that I chose this person beforehand. I then ended up at the South Carolina Tea Party Convention speaking to Mike Cutler about him. And of all things today came in the mail, my New York City Police Department PBA calendar. It's a small world. Evan, I'm going to put up in the chat room, or I think I did already, a picture. No, I didn't. I took a picture of this book I had downloaded. I downloaded the PDF copy, and it's got, I would say, maybe about 50 little yellow stickies on it with notes on your book.
I hope they're good notes.
Absolutely. Matter of fact, when I sent you the email and you said the book is not exactly complete, I don't see how this book ever can be completed.
Well, there's just more examples. I mean, basically, this stands alone. This is, as I was writing it, I didn't want it to be seen as necessarily political. I didn't want it to be seen as a tool to defeat Obama, because although it is, it's not Obama that needs to be defeated. It's modern liberalism. It's the ideology behind Obama. And even if Obama were to be replaced somehow, even if he were impeached over something and replaced, it's an ideology that pervades the culture, pervades the Democratic Party, and defeating one man wouldn't suffice. So I had intended to hold on to the book until after, well after the elections, but people kept saying, as I was turning to people for editorial advice, you got to put at least this main section out for it to be part of the conversation. And so that's what you have now, is it stands alone. It's the four laws of the unified field theory of liberalism. And I think, I hope you'll agree, but if even if you don't, lots and lots of people do, that it's the definitive explanation as to why, look, we know why Marxists support the left. They're Marxists. We know why socialists support the left. They're socialists. But why do otherwise smart, decent, kind, loving people like my cousin, like my neighbor, like my colleagues, why do they support the leftist movement and the Democrat Party? And I think the book explains that.
Yeah, now, you were not always a conservative. You had an epiphany.
I don't know if I'd call it an epiphany, because it was over a stretch of time. No, I grew up a New York City-born liberal Jew, not because I was intellectually a liberal. I don't think there is such a thing as an intellectual liberal, somebody who is liberal because they understand liberalism and support it. But that was what Andrew Breitbart would call the default factory setting of somebody born into those demographics. You just were a liberal, because liberal means, as it's portrayed, nice. Liberal means open-minded. You know, basically, I knew about politics what all Democrats know about politics. Democrats are good, Republicans are evil, and that's all you needed to know. But along came 9/11, and I call myself a 9/13 Republican. Not because it took me an extra 2 days to understand the consequences of the attacks, but because the attacks didn't surprise me. Right? Obviously, I didn't know the date, I didn't know the targets, the carnage sickened me. But even as a brain-dead liberal, I knew just enough about the world to know that the same people who were murdering the Jews of Israel because they were the closest infidels, and who were murdering the Hindus in India because they were the closest infidels, and who were murdering children of Eslam Russia because they were the closest infidels, would, when they could, come and massacre the big infidel, the great Satan. The only reason they hadn't succeeded in murdering us prior to that is because they're so primitive they couldn't figure out a way to get their evil across the oceans. But when these attacks came, what really surprised me was not 9/11, it's what I metaphorically call 9/12. It's the days and the weeks and the months and now the years after 9/11, and my liberal friends' response to the attacks. The notion that we deserve them, that they were, in the words of Jeremiah Wright, Barack Obama's spiritual mentor, the chickens coming home to roost, that we deserve as Americans to be burned alive in our places of employment, because according to Ward Churchill, the chairman of the department at a major university, every American is a little Eichmann. This was insane to me, Anne. And the notion of the way to prevent further attacks was to be nicer to the terrorists, this made no sense to me. So suddenly, faced for the first time ever with an obvious case of good versus evil, to hear the liberals not only siding with evil, but making the most irrational and objectively false arguments in order to defend the evil, I had to begin to think, how is it liberals see the world? And I have an expression, the first time you think is the last time you're a Democrat.
I like that. I like that. Just to get your blood a little boiling, Al Gore was just on TV, and he said Al-Qaeda is feisty, not evil.
That's
not
right.
Destructive, and feisty.
And they're not terrorists, they're freedom fighters. I mean, quite literally, everything is flipped upside down in the modern liberal world, where evil becomes, if not good, then at least the innocent victim to deserving of compassion. And in the book, I explain the four laws of the unified field theory of liberalism and why it is that these laws lead them to side invariably with evil over good, wrong over right, and the behaviors that lead to failure over those that lead to success. And truly, the two that are essential, the first two, the way I'm going to say it now, the way I word it in the book, but then I'll explain it. I say they were raised to believe that indiscriminateness is a moral imperative because its opposite is discrimination. In the 1980s, by no coincidence, when the first children of the 60s were reaching their positions of power and influence in the universities, in the entertainment industry, in government, in journalism, and just as their children were beginning to enter the universities, thinking was outlawed. Thinking was deemed a hate crime to be avoided by all moral people. Right? The concept behind the outlawing of thinking is this, Anne. Anything that you believe, anything that I believe, anything that anybody believes is going to have been so tainted by their personal prejudices. Prejudices we all have that we can't help but have is just part of the human experience. Prejudices based on such things as the color of our skin, the nation of our ancestry, our height, our weight, our sex, and so on. Anything that you believe is going to be so tainted by your prejudices that the only way not to be a bigot is to never think at all.
But oh,
the second law, I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say that is absolutely true. I find it sometimes when I do get into a debate with a liberal, you, and I'm going to ask you to define the difference between a liberal and a modern liberal in a bit, but you know, they give you arguments that have absolutely no thought against behind them. All they do is just regurgitate what they've been taught.
Or else conversely, they simply decry that you are a racist or a homophobe or a xenophobe. And the reason, you know, I love this sign from the Tea Parties. It doesn't matter what this sign says, you'll still say it's racist. And the reason for that is because anything other than indiscriminateness is discrimination. So no matter what, if you disagree with the liberal whose policy is mindless indiscriminateness, for example, open borders, for example, with gun control, indiscriminately take guns away from the good and the bad instead of taking the guns away from the bad. Indiscriminateness as in abortion on demand because human life is nothing special. All right, no matter where you go across the board, you can find the Democrats' position, the modern liberals' position, by asking yourself, if you did not recognize as anything as better or worse than anything else, any culture, any religion, any form of government, any means of finance, any ideology, any familial structure, if you do not recognize anything as better than anything else, you then have the Democrats' position. But the second law of the unified field theory of liberalism is that indiscriminateness of thought doesn't lead to indiscriminateness of policy. It leads invariably, and it leads inevitably to siding with evil, failure, and wrong, and against the good, right, and successful. Why? Because if nothing is better than anything else, if no culture, no religion, no form of government, if nothing is better than anything else, then success, simply by its existence, is unjust. Why should a nation succeed? Why should a business succeed? Why should a person succeed if they're not better than anything else? To the indiscriminate, failure, as proved by nothing other than the fact that it has failed, is proof positive that somehow the failure has been victimized. So you look, for example, at their siding with the terrorists in the Middle East, the oppressive, misogynistic, homophobic Islamic nations in the Middle East, against the democratic, liberal democracy, lowercase l, lowercase d, of Israel. Why in the world? Because they will not judge rape, mass murder, all those things. What they know is the Palestinians are failed and the Jews of Israel are successful. Therefore, the Jews must be oppressing the Palestinians. There is nothing else they're allowed to believe.
Yeah, one tiny little nation, Israel, surrounded nothing but enemy. Israel is the one that is at fault. And it's not the evil of Islamic extremists. It's not that. It's not
Hamas. No, it can't be.
It's not Hamas. It's not that. No.
Right, because they won't judge.
Israel.
They won't judge that. All they know is that those cultures must be equally good and equally right. Let me give you. Let me just take it from a slightly different angle. Let's say you have to believe. You have to believe that both the Palestinians and the Jews want peace. Doesn't everybody want peace? If the Palestinians don't want peace, then there's something evil about their culture. But you're not allowed to believe that because that could just be your prejudices. So to make sure that you have no prejudices, you must start and end your thinking with the belief that the Palestinians and the Jews both want peace. Well, then why are the Palestinians blowing up buses in Jerusalem? The only explanation you can come up with is they must have been provoked. Why else would they do this thing that undermines peace? Why would they go and murder children at Ma'alat in the kindergarten there? They must have been provoked. So the evildoers become the victims of provocation, and their victims become the evildoers.
Yeah, it's a complete reversal. You know, what is right is now wrong. What is wrong is all right.
And this explains why. It's not because they're necessarily evil. My cousin isn't evil. My cousin doesn't love bombs going off in Jerusalem. But unless he can blame it on the Jews, then he has to give up his ideology of liberalism. And since he won't give up his ideology of liberalism, he simply has to blame it on the Jews. Let me give another example. Barack Obama was asked, do you believe in American exceptionalism? He gave a very clever, very politic answer in which he said yes, but made very clear that he meant no. What he said was, yes, I do, just as I'm sure the Brits believe in British exceptionalism and the Greeks believe in Greek exceptionalism. In other words, it's not America's constitution, it's Judeo-Christian heritage, it's Protestant work ethic that makes him believe in American exceptionalism. It's more just rah-rah for the home team. I happen to live here. If I lived in Britain, I would root for Great Britain, et cetera, et cetera. But now Obama and those who share his ideology have a problem. If America is not exceptional, how did we get so prosperous? If America isn't exceptional, how did we get so strong? Well, at the very least, our prosperity is unjust. Why should we be so rich if we're nothing special? And given that we are the most prosperous nation in all of human history, Obama has no choice but to believe that America is the greatest injustice in all of human history. If you cannot recognize the better, then the good becomes bad and the great becomes the worst.
It's as if you take ambition away from the person and you want everyone to be just a little foot soldier to follow behind what you feel is right.
Well, there's certainly a big part of that. There's certainly the ideologues on the left who believe that this is part of their utopian scheme. See, they believe that if nobody believed in anything, then there'd be nothing to fight about. Right? If you didn't believe America was better than Nazi Germany, then we wouldn't go to war with Nazi Germany. Then there'd be peace. So the way that they attempt to bring peace is by undermining the reputation of everything that's exceptionally good, by elevating in esteem and stature everything that's exceptionally evil, until they believe both things meet in the middle and there'll be nothing to fight about. And think about this. This was exactly the paradigm and the purpose of perhaps the most successful modern liberal motion picture ever made. Right? There's nobody who believes Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11 was an honest attempt to accurately portray the real events and the real people of that horrific day and its aftermath. Everybody knows that this modern liberal used his ample skills as a filmmaker to cherry-pick the facts, manipulate the evidence, and offer an agenda-driven line of narrative. And what was that agenda? To show that the United States isn't as good as you think it is, that Saddam Hussein isn't as evil as he appears to be, so that both would meet in the middle, and that way we wouldn't go to war. That's the utopian premise of what I call the true believers on the left. All right. The problem is that in order to prove that the better isn't better, you don't just meet the meat in the middle, just as I showed just now with President Obama. If America isn't anything exceptional, then he can't believe we're in the middle. He must believe we are the worst, because how do we become so exceptionally successful?
And it is amazing, because now you've got North Korea rattling their saber again, and do we hear a single peep out of the White House? No.
Right, not at all. But on the other hand, who are the enemies of this administration? Again, you have it's our allies. You're right at the very beginning of the book, I give a very telling example. It's small, but telling. When President Obama went around the world bowing down before certain people, it's very telling that he bowed down before some, but not others. Now, he said it was to show respect for other cultures. Well, he bowed down before the Saudi king, Saudi Arabia, of course, being the font of virtually every terrorist act on the planet today, they and Iran. I believe it was 15 of the 19 hijackers of 9/11 came from Saudi Arabia. So he bowed to the despotic Saudi king. He bowed to the symbol of Japanese imperialism, to the emperor. You don't bow to the emperor anymore. Right? That's a long gone tradition, but he bowed to the symbol of Japanese imperialism, which brought us the attacks on Pearl Harbor and the Bataan Death March. But he didn't bow when he met the Queen of England. So he bowed to the two people or two offices that brought hell to America, Pearl Harbor and 9/11, but not to our allies. And you saw again with the gifts that he received. He gladly accepted an anti-American propaganda book from Hugo Chavez, but unceremoniously returned a gift of a bust of Winston Churchill to Great Britain.
Yeah, I always found that really amazing, because he gives the Queen, an iPod.
Yeah.
With his speeches on it, put in a format that she can't play there.
Right, but how arrogant is that? To give the Queen of England your speeches.
he gave her a picture of himself.
Yeah.
Yeah, he would, but that wouldn't be enough, because it wouldn't be talking. You know, he also needs to hear himself.
Mm-hmm. And on top of which, Michelle Obama compounded the insult by placing her hand on the Queen. That is something that no one does.
Right, and it's been known for centuries. Nobody touches the Queen. It's simply a fact. That's their tradition. That's their culture. And this is not a mistake. They get briefed before they go overseas and they interact with other people in other cultures. They were told point blank not to touch her. But what they wanted to do was show respect for our enemies, elevate our enemies in esteem and stature, and show disdain for our allies. Denigrate them, lower them, lessen them, whether it was Sarkozy who he snubbed, whether it's Netanyahu who he snubbed, whether it's the Dalai Lama who he made exit the White House past his trash. mean, in every instance, he spits on our allies and elevates our enemies, and this is not an accident. It's not Barack Obama. It's modern liberalism. It is an ideology that invariably champions all that's evil, failed, and wrong, and invariably sides against all that is good, right, and successful. And it's not because they're evil. It's because modern liberalism is a sick and twisted ideology that has been foisted upon our children starting from the time they enter kindergarten, even before.
Yeah, and if you remember correctly also, when he was visiting the Moscow, he was standing in a line, a reception line, and not one single Russian dignitary shook his hand or acknowledged his presence.
I don't know exactly what that means, but I don't know exactly what that means.
It is just that the Russian has complete disdain for President Obama.
Yes, absolutely.
Reagan or even Bush, I know how cool Mike does not like Bush, but this would not have occurred with either him or Reagan.
Well, that's correct. I mean, there's one thing that's for sure is that neither our enemies nor our allies have much respect for this president. Our enemies recognize him to be what liberals have always been called. They've always been called useful idiots. They're useful to the causes of evil, and they're idiots because they're literally, as the book says, they are morally and intellectually retarded at the level of the five-year-old child. I mean, this is why I call the book The Kindergarten of Eden. It's because the utopian ideology of the left requires them to be morally and intellectually retarded, to have their growth, intellectual growth, stopped at the age of five. And as ludicrous as this sounds, there's actually a book written by one of them, a book called All I Ever Need to Know I Learned in Kindergarten. And instead of people laughing this man off of the planet for admitting that he's a moron, for saying that if he had not learned anything more after he turned 6 years old than he did, he'd be exactly as wise as he is today. And millions of people said, yes, I agree with this man, and bought his book and gave it as gifts and read it and reread it so that it's one of the biggest selling books in all of human history.
And this is absolutely amazing, because if you've learned everything by the age of five, where is your ambition to better yourself? And that's the exact point, to remove that ambition.
Right, there absolutely is none. And in fact, again, in the book, it talks about how Western civilization was predicated on people trying to better themselves. But the liberal believes himself to have been born morally perfect, and therefore his job in life is not to better himself, it's to just always be himself. Then he spends the rest of his life learning to love himself as he is. And you can even look at the institutions that you associate with the left and the right. The institutions we associate with the right are all about bettering yourself, whether it's going to church to better your soul or whether it's joining the Boy Scouts to better yourself in preparation and in a physical sense, whereas the groups you associate with the left are all designed to change society to the leftist's liking. They don't change. They don't grow. They're incapable of growth. That's why I say over and over again in the book, they are morally and intellectually retarded at the level of the five-year-old child. Yes, they learn bigger words. Yes, they grow, they become more articulate. Yes, the rhetoric they use sounds more sophisticated as they grow older. But if you boil down the pseudo-intellectual rhetoric to its essence, it is exactly what they believed when they were five-year-old children. And in the bigger version of the book coming out next year or this year sometime, whenever it does, I give an example that I don't use in this book yet, which is, look, everybody starts out loving the United Nations. I mean, I remember being a five-year-old child walking around the neighborhood on Halloween with a bag for candy and a box for nickels and dimes and pennies that we would all give to UNICEF, to the United Nations.
Oh, I remember
then
that,
what happened
yeah.
to... Yep. Then what happens is you turn 6, you turn 10, you turn 20, you turn 30. You learn more things about the United Nations. You learn about how the peacekeepers turned their backs so the Rwandans could be massacred. You learn how the Iranians are made head of the Women's Rights Committee, or the Sudanese are made head of the Human Rights Committee while they're committing genocide. And these things, you and I, what I call the right-thinking people, factor these things into our knowledge about the United Nations, and we alter our beliefs about the United Nations. We now recognize the UN to be a font of evil. But the liberal still loves the United Nations just like he did when he was five. It's not because he doesn't know about the Rwandan massacres. He does. But the rule in kindergarten is don't hit anyone. And since the peacekeepers didn't hit anyone, and you only learn about massacres after the age of six, they don't really need to know about the massacre because it wouldn't change their adoration for the UN. But it's not that they don't know about the genocide in the Sudan or the Sudanese on the Human Rights Committee. They know these things. They just don't really need to know them because they won't factor it into their thinking because thinking has been outlawed. They adore the United Nations because the United Nations is indiscriminate. Everybody's invited to the party. You know, in kindergarten, the rule is every child must get a turn. So when they see the Sudanese on the Human Rights Committee, they don't think about the genocide. That's something they learned about after they turned six. They love the United Nations because it was the Sudanese turn, and that's the rule in kindergarten. That's all they ever need to know.
That's true. Now, your book, The Kindergarten of Eden, How the Modern Liberal Thinks and Why He's Convinced That Ignorance is Bliss, is up on your website, and your website's very simple. It's just your name, Evan Sayed, sayet.com. And I put that link up on the chat room, and it should be up also on the show page. So if anyone wants to get the book, you can download it for as little as $4.99 in PDF form. You can get it in Kindle form, however you want. You can download the book. It's a great book to have. And like I said, I've got about 50 different little tabs here. Oh, why don't you give us the difference between a modern liberal and the liberals of yesterday,
such as John Kennedy? Sure, and I struggle to come up with an appropriate name because the truth is they're not liberal at all. And I know, for example, Bill O'Reilly uses secular progressives, but there's nobody who calls himself a secular progressive. There's no secular progressive movement, and I felt that things like that would not make it clear just how prevalent this ideology is. So they tend to call themselves liberals, so I wanted to call them liberals, and then I inserted the modifier modern to make clear that they're not the classical liberal like John F. Kennedy. In fact, they're not even liberal. All right? Take John Kennedy, classic liberal's most iconic statement. Ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. And ask what the modern liberal's take on that would be. Well, their take would be exactly the opposite. It would be demand that your country do virtually everything for you. Look at this woman, Sandra Fluck. She is in her fourth decade on this planet and has contributed absolutely nothing to the betterment of mankind. She has not left the school ground, even though she's in her fourth decade, and her only claim to fame is that having done nothing, she's demanding more free things for herself. Right? Ask not what your country can do for you. No, look at this thing, Julia, that the president had up, this woman who couldn't get through life unless the government was there at every turn to do for her, to give her more. And on the flip side, ask what you can do for your country. Well, the modern liberal sees that as xenophobic. They don't have a country. They're citizens of the world. So in every way, the classical liberal would be despised. John Kennedy would be despised by today's Democratic Party.
Yeah, actually, I do believe that. And it's funny, I'm looking at what's going on in the chat room as you're talking, and how they're talking about how Clinton treated the 93 attack on the World Trade Center as a law enforcement matter. And I completely agree. It should never have been a law enforcement matter. As a matter of fact, I was on duty inside the 9-0 precinct that day that happened, and my sister-in-law was inside the building when it was attacked.
I have a question I want to throw for our guest, if you don't mind. Two questions, actually. Number one is, I love the front cover of this book. People who aren't even going to buy it need to just look at the front cover. You got the
kids
in the
background. No, they should buy it. Don't look at the front cover unless you buy it.
All right,
you are forbidden from looking at the front cover until you buy it.
Well, they got kids in the background on a teeter-totter, and you got an apple with a snake going through it. I mean, the cover kind of is a great introduction to the book. Two questions. What's happened to the so-called old conservative Republican that now seems to be way, way, way left, or at least somewhere out to lunch? Also, talking Middle East politics, are there also groups within, say, the West Bank or whatever, that need, kind of like Jesse Jackson and all them are poverty pimps around here, are there people there that need to keep this war with Israel going, or else you know, their livelihood implodes?
Okay, let me take the second one first, and then I don't think that's truly the issue at this time. Are there people who need the war to be going on? Yeah, but I have no doubt it's far more of an ideological war. It's a war between two diametrically opposed and mutually exclusive ideologies. Judaism, which is progressive, which believes that time moves forward, mankind can create things to make things better, and this Islamism that is primitive, that believes that we need to live the way Muhammad lived and stop time 1,600 years ago. And this war in the Middle East is completely an Islamic war against any and all infidels. And it's not just in the Middle East. Every war on the planet today, I believe there's something like 30 wars on the planet today, every single one of them involves Islam trying to wipe somebody else off the planet. Every place that there's genocide, it's Islam committing it. Whether it was the Marsh Arabs in the Middle East, in Iraq, whether it's the Sudanese, whether it's the Coptic Christians, whether it's the folks, the Christians in Lebanon, everywhere you look, it is 100% a function of Islam that cannot live with other peoples. As far as where are the conservatives, the real fighters for conservative values in the Republican Party? I have an odd expression that I use. I say the worst thing that ever happened to this nation was air conditioning. Because it used to be that people went to Washington, D.C. because it was their duty, because it was their patriotic duty to go, and they left as quickly as they could because it was marshy and it was hot and it was mosquito-y. And now we have career politicians. And unfortunately, career politicians exist much more on the left than on the right, by the way. If you look at Barack Obama, he's never had a job. John McCain served in the military. Sarah Palin ran a small business. George Bush worked in the oil fields. Ronald Reagan had all sorts of jobs prior to becoming a politician. But when you have career politicians, they are removed from the realities of the day-to-day world. In my book, I make a very clear distinction that the left is dominated by people who work in what I call the rhetoric industries. All words and no action. You have the entertainer who emotes. You have the journalist who reports. You have the academic who lectures. I forget who I left out. I left out a group in there. But when you don't actually work in the real world, there's no cost or consequence to being wrong. And so you have even Republicans who lose the recognition of right and wrong because they live in this utopia where they can't lose their jobs because of redistricting. Even if they do lose their jobs, eventually they have lifelong pensions. And unfortunately, both Republicans and Democrats, more Democrats than Republicans, but both lose touch with reality, and conservatism is all about reality. It's the grown-up reality that, no, solar panels don't work, so let's find better ways to drill for oil. Not solar panels would be nice if they worked, and it doesn't make any difference because I don't want a business anyway.
Did we lose our guest?
Maybe a quiet spot for a minute, but. those are really good points, and you know, I don't know. I'll make a statement, and you can just comment on it. How can we as people be so damn blind? I mean, it's like we're getting hit in the head with a baseball bat, and we don't feel it.
Okay, here's the answer. The world after World War II was unlike anything mankind had ever known, from the dawn of time until. Just after World War II, people had to be smart because they had to avoid things like disease, hunger, poverty, and physical pain. Anybody born after World War II, disease, what disease? Polio was vanquished. Smallpox was vanquished. Chickenpox was vanquished. The flu as a death sentence that had wiped out two-thirds of a continent. Now it's a three-day paid vacation where you sit on your lazy boy chair and you watch one of 2,000 television channels. Hunger? Are you kidding? If you find a dollar in the street, you can go to the 99-cent store and get a three-course TV dinner. Physical pain, they didn't even have aspirin. Now aspirin's in everybody's medicine cabinet. So you don't need to be smart now, because being wrong comes with no consequences. And if you add to that the Democratic Party that gives you 99 weeks of unemployment and gives you welfare payments and gives you free cell phones and gives you free condoms and gives you free this, then there's no reason to be smart, because even if you're stupid, you live longer than anybody else in human history. You live in more luxury than anybody else in human history. Even the poorest amongst us have hot and cold running showers. What would a czar have given for that? Even the poorest amongst us have air conditioning in the summer and heat in the winter. What would a pharaoh have given for that? So you can now be an abject moron and still live better than anybody who has ever lived in the history of the world. And if you enter one of the rhetoric industries, then you can be a moron because you can't get hurt. If all you do is talk for a living, you don't need to know what you're talking about.
It sounds like Bill Maher. Now, this brings me up to the question of the day. How the heck did a conservative end up writing comedy for Bill Maher? How the heck did you tolerate it?
There's three things that need to be known about that. One, he wasn't so far to the left when I wrote the show. I wasn't so far to the right when I wrote the show. And the deal that I made is that I wrote the show from 3,000 miles away. He was doing the show out of New York, and I stayed in Los Angeles as much as I could. I would fly in periodically and bite my lip and pull my hair and scream when into my pillow. But for the most part, I was blessed not to have to deal with him on a day-to-day basis.
All right. My next question is, where in Brooklyn were you from?
Well, my mom's from Brooklyn. My mom's from Flatbush. We still have relatives just beyond Coney Island and Seagate. My dad was from the Bronx, and like a lot of people post-World War II, mom and dad moved the kids continually eastward. So Fresh Meadows, and then we ended up on Long Island in one of those Levittown-like houses that World War II vets moved into.
Ah, that's interesting, because I had worked in the 90th, which is off of Union Avenue in the BQE. So I was in the north end of Brooklyn when I worked as a police officer, but we lived out on the island. We were over in Westbury.
Well, I know Westbury extremely well. In fact, my high school graduation was in the Westbury Music Fair.
When my mother and I had a travel agency, we were exclusive travel agents for all the stars that went in and out of there. I know Westbury Music Fair very, very well.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and that's where I went to see, you know, the great comedians that so inspired me, whether it was Buddy Hackett, not that I'm Buddy Hackettian, if that's a word, but nonetheless, that's where we saw the great talent. I'll tell you what, never saw better than the night of Hal Linden and Ben Vereen. The two of them just put on this show separately and then together, that was magic.
Oh, wow. Yeah, because I saw a bunch. I remember seeing Burt Bacharach, Anthony Newley, trying to remember some of the people that I saw there. One day I came walking into the travel agency after picking up lunch for everyone, and there's Yul Brynner sitting there. It was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun back then.
Yep.
But you and I are pretty close in age. Pretty close.
Okay. I'm assuming you know how old I am then.
I think you're like maybe about a year or two older than I am. So
okay,
I'm not going beyond that.
Okay, and we'll keep it that way. I'll be a year or two ahead of you forever now.
So when you got the job writing for that show, which incidentally those were the golden years. I mean, he soared, ratings soared then. Like, how did you end up even applying for that job? That, like it or not like it, I mean, that's just got to be a fascinating whole big picture of that show. I mean, it launched on as Bill Maher when people didn't have cable.
Right, so it was a terrific show. In fact, back then, I didn't even know the show existed because out here, we didn't get it. I don't think we had Comedy Central or whatever the reason was, but we didn't get it. I got a call from my sister who said there was a show I'm watching that you'd be perfect for, and it turned out the executive producer had been a comedian that I had come across through the years, always enjoyed his work. He always enjoyed my work. So I contacted him, and he sent me videos every day of the show from the night before, and I just started writing monologue jokes and the appropriate bits, And within 3 weeks, almost every joke in the monologue turned out to be mine, so they hired me.
Yeah, that's just interesting because you're talking about work, but one thing that the modern liberal hates is anyone that works. And you go to this book, and you use a lot of Bruce Springsteen's lyrics as examples.
I know, it kills me because I'm a huge Springsteen fan, but on the other hand, his lyrics, when it comes to interpersonal relationships, he's very strong. He gives very good advice in his lyrics. But when it comes to things like having a job, he has the liberal concept of a job, which is that it is the worst thing that could possibly happen to a human being, that having a job steals your soul. You see, one of the things about being retarded at the level of the small child is that the liberal's purpose in life is to do what feels good to him. In fact, one of the founding mantras of what I call the cult of indiscriminateness was, if it feels good, do it. Well, having a job doesn't always feel good, and it prevents you from being yourself at every given moment. Sometimes you have to do what the boss says. Sometimes you have to be someplace you don't want to be. Sometimes you have to lift something heavy. Sometimes you have to. So the liberal not only sees work as hard work, having a job is hard work, he sees it as soul-stealing. It prevents you from being you. And if you listen to Springsteen's lyrics, not only is your soul stolen. So there's a line from a song where he describes his father, and he says, "Daddy worked his whole life for nothing but the pain." And then not only do the liberals think if you have a job, you must be soulless, but you must then become violent. And in almost every Springsteen song, somebody with a job has had his soul stolen from him and then turns violent. So Daddy worked his whole life for nothing but the pain. Now he walks these empty rooms. He's looking for something to blame. The factory worker leaves the factory with death in his eyes, and you just better believe, boy, somebody's going to get hurt tonight. The garage mechanic wants to explode and tear this whole town apart. The guy who works on the highway kidnaps a girl and rapes her. I mean, I cannot think of a single Springsteen song where having a job is anything less than a living hell, and there's virtually none where that doesn't then translate into the guy with a job exploding into violence.
And yet statistics show that people that do maintain jobs are healthier and happier than people that don't.
It's 180 degrees from the truth yet again. Everything, Anne, everything. That's why it's called the unified field theory of liberalism. Everything fits this paradigm where the modern liberal is not only always wrong, he is as wrong can be, diametrically opposed to the truth, and in every case, to the benefit of the evil, failed, and wrong, and to the detriment of the good, right, and successful. Yes, having a job is not only not soul-stealing, it is life-affirming. If you have a job where you can make the world a better place, whether that's as a plumber who allows everybody to have one, or an electrician who allows lights to go on in people's homes, if you believe in the existence of the better, and then having a job and being good at that job is life-affirming, it's exactly the opposite of what the liberal believes. But the liberal believes that having a job is the greatest evil in the world.
Yeah, and for some reason, they think that because Tea Party people, majority of them are people that had or have jobs. They're either retired from a lifelong work or they're still actively working. And I think that's one of the reasons why they think we are so evil and we're about ready to explode in violence.
Right, there's no doubt about it. Look, there is absolutely no objective evidence, no objective reason for the media to conclude that the Tea Party is a violent movement. My goodness, if you go to a Tea Party gathering, when you leave, there's not even litter. They are so peaceable, there's not even litter, and yet the media portrays it as a movement on the verge of violence. Now, it's not because the media is this evil, intentionally lying people. There's something in their ideology that leads them to ignore the objective facts and conclude that the Tea Party is about to become violent. And the reason is specifically this, because the Tea Party is comprised of people who have jobs. By definition, when you're saying I've been taxed enough already, that means that you are paying taxes. Who pays taxes are the people with jobs. So the reason that the left is convinced the Tea Party is about to explode into violence is for no other reason than if you have a job, you must be violent.
That makes sense. Can't have too many people working nowadays.
Well, that's why Democratic Party policy is not about creating more jobs. It's about giving people means and reasons and the ability to leave their jobs. In fact, Nancy Pelosi, and this is a quote in the book as well, Nancy Pelosi talking about Obama's 2,000-plus page health care scheme that she didn't read, doesn't know what's in it, that's filled with ports, that's filled with all, and filled with tens of thousands of rules, laws, mandates, dictates, diktats. And she said, quote, "We see this as an entrepreneurial bill, a bill that says if you want to leave your job, go ahead and pursue your music career. Because now you'll know that you're covered." And by the way, I said, quote, that was a paraphrase. I didn't remember the quote exactly. But nonetheless, quote, "We see this as an entrepreneurial bill," end quote. And then the explanation is that if you want to leave your job and pursue your passion, in other words, your feelings, go ahead and do it because now you don't have to pay for your own health care.
Yeah, I've got your quote marked here where she said, "We see it as an entrepreneurial bill, a bill that says to someone, if you want to be creative and be a musician or whatever, you can leave your work, focus on your talent, your skill, your passion, your aspirations." Thank you, Nancy Pelosi. We passed the bill, so now we know what's in it, I think.
What good is your health care if you starve to death?
Well, that's exactly right. But at that point, they'll also be able to get an NEA grant. At that point, they'll also be able to, if they've just left their job, get 99 weeks of unemployment. And if they just left, they can go and they can get welfare. And if they can go and they can get food stamps. And they can go. And so now, in addition to all those other things that allow them to not work, they also know that they have their health care covered. So it's just another reason they can quit their jobs and go. And by the way, it doesn't say get good at music. Who wouldn't want to sit and play music all day on the beach if that's your choice versus having a job? All right, so who's going to determine which musician is worthy? You know, there was a time when there were two ways that you found out which musician was worthy. Somebody spent their own money on their product, or you found somebody who was your patron who gave you a lot of money because they really believed in your talent. But now you have bureaucrats who are giving away somebody else's money via the NEA. They have no vested interest. They have no knowledge. It's just another mechanism for eliminating violence from society by eliminating jobs.
It is absolutely amazing. You know, there's a couple of things I came across today. Number one, Tina Turner is giving up her U.S. citizenship to go to Switzerland. She's getting a Swiss passport instead. That's just absolutely wonderful. And then Phil Mickelson yesterday apologized for criticizing California for raising taxes on the upper wealthy 1%.
Yeah, and you look at Gerard Depardieu wanting to leave France because of the high taxes. You know, there's a very big percentage of the Democrat Party that is comprised of people. It's really comprised of two kinds of folks economically: the very, very, very rich and the poor. And they have a couple of things in common. One of them is that they are removed from the consequences of bad policy. The very, very, very rich are removed because they can, A, hire attorneys to get them around it, like Bruce Springsteen, who doesn't pay New Jersey property taxes because he hired some flunkies to plant some tomatoes, and now he declares himself a farmer, therefore he doesn't have to pay his property taxes. And those are the very, very bottom who don't suffer the consequences of bad policy because they don't pay the taxes, they don't run the businesses, they don't own the businesses. So you have these two groups that are unaffected by policy voting on policy that affects the rest of us.
Now, it makes me really, really proud at times. Listen, I came across this clip, and believe it or not, Paul Harvey made this little poem titled "If I Were the Devil." He did this back in 1965. It's only about 3 minutes long, but I want to play it for you and then get you to comment on what he said then and how it relates to today. This is great. Let's see, here we go.
If I were the devil, if I were the devil, if I were the prince of darkness, I'd want to engulf the whole world in darkness, and I'd have a third of its real estate and four-fifths of its population, but I wouldn't be happy until I had seized the ripest apple on the tree, thee. So I'd set about however necessary to take over the United States. I'd subvert the churches first. I'd begin with a campaign of whispers. With the wisdom of a serpent, I would whisper to you as I whispered to Eve. Do as you please. To the young, I would whisper that the Bible is a myth. I would convince them that man created God instead of the other way around. I would confide that what's bad is good and what's good is square. And the old, I would teach to pray after me, our Father, which art in Washington. And then I'd get organized. I'd educate authors in how to make lurid literature exciting so that anything else would appear dull and uninteresting. I'd threaten TV with dirtier movies and vice versa. I'd peddle narcotics to whom I could. I'd sell alcohol to ladies and gentlemen of distinction. I'd tranquilize the rest with pills. If I were the devil, I'd soon have families at war with themselves, churches at war with themselves, and nations at war with themselves until each in its turn was consumed. And with promises of higher ratings, I'd have mesmerizing media fanning the flames. If I were the devil, I would encourage schools to refine young intellects, but neglect to discipline emotions. Just let those run wild. Until before you knew it, you'd have to have drug-sniffing dogs and metal detectors at every schoolhouse door. Within a decade, I'd have prisons overflowing. I'd have judges promoting pornography. Soon I could evict God from the courthouse, then from the schoolhouse, and then from the houses of Congress. And in his own churches, I would substitute psychology for religion and deify science. I would lure priests and pastors into misusing boys and girls and church money. If I were the devil, I'd make the symbol of Easter an egg and the symbol of Christmas a bottle. If I were the devil, I'd take from those who have and give to those who wanted until I had killed the incentive of the ambitious. And what'll you bet? I couldn't get whole states to promote gambling as the way to get rich. I would caution against extremes in hard work, in patriotism, in moral conduct. I would convince the young that marriage is old-fashioned, that swinging is more fun, that what you see on TV is the way to be. And thus I could undress you in public, and I could lure you into bed with diseases for which there is no cure. In other words, if I were the devil, I'd just keep right on doing what he's doing.
Paul Harvey. Good day.
Now, that was 1965, 20 years before we finally found out what, you know, AIDS existed. And you think about this, about the TV shows you have on there, the reality series, each and every state now participates in a lottery. People end up millionaires overnight. You think about everything he said, and it's come true.
Yeah, I mean, once you eliminate discrimination, discriminating thought, not the evils of discrimination, discriminating thought, saying this is right, this is wrong, this is better, this is worse, this is good, this is evil. Once you do it, you don't have everything meet in the middle. Evil replaces the good. This is, you know, his three-minute story where he delineates all of these things. They follow exactly the four laws and the three corollaries of the unified field theory of liberalism. You know, I was trying to pick and choose as going through there the examples, but you know how it is, you tend to forget as he moves on to the next one. But talking about metal detectors and drug-sniffing dogs in our schools, again, that comes from the notion that you can't discriminate against the bad guy. So now you have to, it's sort of like the way that we can't focus on who the terrorists likely are, so now we have to search everybody. As if it's just as likely that the Swedish great-great-grandmother is going to blow up the next plane and not that 27-year-old Islamic imam yelling Allahu Akbar as he washes his feet in the sink. You know, one of the lines that I use, I know I use it in my famous speech to the Heritage Foundation, but I don't know if it's in this version of the book, but that they have to intentionally make themselves stupid. They have to intentionally pretend they don't know things that they know in order to defend, in order to defend evil and to side against good.
And it is. And I when I was reading your book, I thought back to this clip that I had found, you know, I don't know, about a month or so ago. And everything that Paul Harvey said, you were basically saying the same exact thing in your book.
Absolutely. It's the four laws and the three corollaries. Look, there's a reason that I went to Washington, D.C. in 2007. I went there as a complete unknown political pundit into an industry town of politics. I gave this 47-minute long wonkish speech. I didn't use my humor. It was like the book. It was a straightforward, almost scientific deconstruction of the left. And in this town where they get 50 books a day dropped on their desks by different authors, 100 speeches every day, 1,000 articles every day, for some reason this talk went viral. This talk was passed amongst the experts back and forth. So now almost 1 million people have seen my original lecture upon which the book is based. I remember what National Review Online wrote. It's one of my favorite things. They said, this talk by Evan Sayat, and they linked to it. This talk by Evan Sayat is cramming our inboxes. Please stop sending it. And the reason that this talk broke out the way that it did is because, you have to forgive me for this, but because it's right, because it is the definitive explanation. You know, to just return to almost the very first thing I said to you, we understand how the Marxist thinks. This book is not about Marxism. We understand how the socialist thinks. This book's not about the socialist. This book is about the majority of the people who still vote Democrat, who don't believe in Marxism, who don't want a communist, who don't want more drugs, who don't want our children impregnated or having abortions or dying of uncurable diseases, and yet invariably side with the party that gives us all those things.
Yeah, I'm trying to cut and paste your YouTube video up there. I'm having a little bit of a hard time doing it for some reason. My cut and paste is not working.
Well, okay, you can move to YouTube.
Yeah,
I'll do it.
I've got it up here. I watched it last night, and I'm just my husband's looking at me, and I'm like, don't you dare tell me to turn this one off. And it was a fantastic, fantastic video. And yet, it is 47 minutes. You went nonstop, and I was riveted.
And no teleprompter.
Really?
One of my favorite lines is that Andrew Breitbart, who I barely knew at that point, he didn't even want to watch it. People kept sending it to him, and he said, I know Evan, he's a comedian. What can I possibly do to help him? He said, finally, you heard from enough people, you've got to watch this talk. And Andrew said it was one of the five most important conservative speeches ever given.
Yeah, and you basically went over the same thing that you have in the book. Now, you also point out Rabbi Joshua Hammerman and how some of the religious leaders have been corrupted by modern liberalism to the point where they have someone like Tim Tebow they vilify.
Yeah, you have to keep in mind that a lot of these jobs, rabbi, and is in the rhetoric industry, you know. And as much as Judaism has been always been about discriminating thought, I mean, that's what the Talmud is debate and discussion to the most minute detail to decide what is right and what is wrong, what is moral and what is immoral. But this Rabbi Hammerman and a lot of the Reform Jewish rabbis, they are not Jewish. They are liberals. And what they might do is they might find a line in Scripture that they can then shove in to support their liberalism. But they have given up Judaism because modern liberalism is the antithesis of Judaism. The great gift of the Jews was the concept of justice. Prior to the Jews, if you stepped on the Pharaoh's toe, he could kill you and your family. This line that is often misunderstood, and I think sometimes intentionally so, but an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, was not a call for vengeance. Quite the opposite. It was the first time in human history that the call was that the punishment must not exceed the crime. All right, it might have been a tad too poetic. It might be, but the point is that if somebody does you a certain degree of harm, the punishment cannot exceed what the crime was. This notion of justice is the antithesis of modern liberalism, which seeks to reward the failed, the evil, and the wrong, and to punish the hardworking, the good, the right, and the successful. Now, by the way, you can draw a straight line from, there are basically four kinds of Jews. There's the secular Jew who just happened to have been born to a Jewish mother, but is in no way a practicing or devout or even interested Jew. Then you've got your Jews who do something in their life by choice that is Jewish. The Reformed Jew does one thing in his entire life that's Jewish. He joins a synagogue. That's what makes him a Reformed Jew. But he doesn't join the synagogue to better learn Jewish culture, Jewish practice, Jewish law. He joins the synagogue because basically it's a recreation center. It's a place where he can go where people also like bagels. It's a place where he can go where he might meet somebody who thinks a guy who looks like Marvin Hamlisch is attractive. It's a social setting. It's not really a religious setting. So the secular Jew almost always votes liberal. The Reformed Jew consistently votes liberal. You get to the more Jewish Jew by practice and belief, the conservative Jew and the Orthodox Jew, and they overwhelmingly support the Republican Party and the conservative movement. So the more Jewish you are by practice and by belief, the less likely you are to fall victim to this pro-evil, anti-good ideology of modern liberalism. And by the way, I said a moment ago that justice was the great gift of the Jews. Even the liberals know that they don't seek justice. This is why they have to insert a modifier, social, before the word justice. You don't need to modify the word justice if you seek justice, but they don't. They seek social justice, which is defined as anyone who has succeeded must have had some unfair advantage. Therefore, social justice demands that he be punished, that his wealth be taken away, that if you have a business, you didn't build it. So justice demands then that we confiscate your successes, your ill-gotten fruits, and give it to the people who they didn't build the business for whatever reason, probably racism, bigotry, homophobia, xenophobia, etc.
Yeah, I always loved the argument that when Obama said, if you have business you didn't build, I would hear the modern liberals say, well, of course you didn't build it. You know, you got that just because our taxes paid for the road, our taxes paid for the law enforcement, our taxes paid for this or that. Excuse me? Didn't I also pay those taxes? But I had
weren't there lots and lots of people who also had access to that road who didn't pull over, start a business here, but decided they wanted to keep going until they hit the beach and sat there and smoked dope until they ran out of money? I mean, yeah, okay, fine. We need roads in order to conduct our business. But lots and lots of people had access to the same roads. You know, he also said, you probably had a great teacher. Well, you know what? There were 25 other kids in that class with me who had that same teacher. She taught there for 40 years. So please don't make me do the math because I went to public schools. But 40 times 25 and all the other great teachers, why is it that one person in that class succeeded and others didn't? Obviously, there is something that you bring to the game when you start a business, and it tends to be hard work, dedication, and, yes, smarts.
Right, and the audacity to even go beyond being employed by someone else to be an employer. Now, they did not build that business. You know, I built it when I had my travel agency through hard work. And, yes, there were times I went home without a paycheck so that the people that worked for me could be paid. You know,
absolutely.
I provided jobs. I provided a product for someone, you know, the product being their enjoyment of a vacation or a business trip. You know, I helped them create more business by having that agency.
And then you gave them experience, which if they had the wisdom to save some of the money that they earned, and if they had the wisdom to invest wisely, and if they had the desire and the courage and the motivation, they could then go on to start their own business. So you provided them with much more than just a job. You provided them with an opportunity for them to then build their business. But if you come from this notion that if you have a business, you didn't build it, that gives them the right then to confiscate it from you.
Absolutely. We're coming down to our last 10 minutes here, Evan, and this is has flown, and this time has flown like unbelievable.
Wait, I got to interrupt, Annie, because I'm dying to ask them two questions.
Go ahead.
Number one, what is Bill Maher like, say, when you're talking to him, like standing right next to him? Secondly, how can we change this? How can we do a 360 and somehow just change the direction of this going off the cliff?
Yeah. You know, my mom taught me if you can't say anything nice about somebody, don't say anything at all. So I'm going to pass on to Bill Maher. He's not a good human being. And you know, it's one of the reasons that I've been so happy to remove myself from Hollywood. The truth is, there are very few good liberals. There are nice liberals, and Maher's not one of them. There are entertaining and fun, you know, liberals. But as far as good, because the notion of seeking out what is good, to better yourself, to make yourself good, is anathema to the left. In the book, I say point blank, not only are they taught not to seek the good, because in order to seek the good, you have to use your tainted intellect. How do you know that's really good what you're seeking and you haven't just been brainwashed by those evil church people who want you to do their bidding? So the left is taught not only don't do good, but don't even seek the good. Do what feels good. And Maher is a wonderful example of somebody who does not do good. How can we turn it around? Okay, there's good news and there's bad news, and then there's good news and there's bad news, and on and on like that.
Sorry, I asked the question already.
I literally wake up on alternative days sick to my stomach about how the war is lost and jumping to my feet, recognizing that this war can't be lost. We're just too right, and rightness and goodness and must prevail. What we have to keep in mind is America is not divided in two. We're divided in three. There are those of us who get it, that good and evil, right and wrong, better and worse, truth and lies, ugly and beautiful do exist, and that America is the epitome of goodness on this planet, in the history of this planet. And this is why what we seek to conserve are American values, Judeo-Christian heritage, the Protestant work ethic, et cetera, et cetera. That's why we call ourselves conservatives. That's what we seek to conserve. In fact, in some ways, we are, you asked me earlier, where you know, the difference between liberals and modern liberals. The truth is that liberalism, lowercase L, now resides in the Republican Party. Because what it is we seek to conserve, no, fortunately so. I'm talking about lowercase L. Because what we seek to conserve is this liberal democracy, lowercase L, lowercase D. The left doesn't seek to conserve freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of assembly, freedom, the things that are truly lowercase L liberal. So for those of us who get it and we vote Republican, we call ourselves conservatives, all the way on the other side are the people that you can't do anything about, the Rosie O'Donnells. What fact are you going to put before Rosie O'Donnell that's going to make her say, oh, I did not know that. Now I love America. This is a woman who said 9/11 was an inside job. And her proof of the pudding was that never before in human history had fire melted steel. Well, that's a pretty powerful scientific argument with one tiny flaw. Fire is how you melt steel. Right? Every piece of steel that has ever been melted has been melted through fire and heat. So what fact are you going to put before this, forgive me, but this moron that's going to change her mind? Nothing. But there's a whole bunch in the middle. I would say literally 80% of the people who still vote Democrat, who don't hate America, who don't want to side with evil, who don't, they have never heard from a conservative what a conservative believes. They have only heard from liberals what conservatives believe, and of course what we believe is racism, sexism, homophobia, xenophobia. Where would they have heard it? Think about this. There are three media that the left despises. There's Fox News, there's talk radio, and there's the blogosphere.
Right.
Well, Fox News is only 15 years old. So if you're my age, that means you were into your fifth decade on this planet before Fox News even existed. If you want to tie the phenomenon of talk radio to Rush Limbaugh's syndication, that's only 20 years ago. That means I was 32. I was through my schooling, through my university studies, married with children, well into my career, before there was a single voice in any sort of broadcast, radio or television, that wasn't from the left. And then there's the blogosphere. Well, when did Al Gore invent the internet? In the mid-90s? All right? And the blogosphere didn't really come into its own until those guys in their pajamas caught Dan Rather trying to steal the 2004 election by using forged documents. So if you're my age, or if you're anywhere around my age, where would you have heard what conservatives believe from a conservative? So what we need to do is a program I call Adopt a Democrat. Right, find one person in your life who you know is not a Rosie O'Donnell, brain dead, hate America, always liberal. Find somebody in your life, and over the course of time, don't pick every fight. It's just like raising a little child. Sometimes you even let them win the argument. Like you let your five-year-old beat you to the front door and you tell them how cute and smart and wonderful they are. But over the course of time, whenever they say something particularly stupid and particularly evil, like Bush is Hitler, or Sarah Palin is the stupidest person, or tax cuts for the rich, or any of the other mindless things they spit out because they've never heard anything else, tell them, you know what? I know that that's what you believe. Let me tell you what I believe. That if you cut taxes across the board, it stimulates the economy across the board. Both John Kennedy and Ronald Reagan agreed on this. You know what? You're not going to convince them right there. But over the course of time, and as they see it more, and maybe they'll meet me, or maybe they'll meet whomever else. And over the course of time, you can win these people over. I sit at the coffee shop where I do my writing. And one of the reasons I sit there every day, and I used to put an Ann Coulter book on the table as bait. And over the course of time, they would yell at me and tell me I was a bigot and a racist, and one by one by one, they now all come up to me and whisper. They all whisper still, but they all whisper, "You were right."
What a dirty dog. He puts the Ann Coulter book up there as bait. Gotta love it.
Well, Evan, it's absolutely fantastic. And I want to invite you back. And your book does come out in hard copy. I'm going to ask you to sign a copy and send it to me.
Well, absolutely. There's a print version that's available now that they can send away for, and I think it gets there in a week or less. I don't know exactly. And that's doing extremely well. The Kindle version is doing extremely well. I don't know if you're listeners. I don't know if you guys are fans of Bill Whittle, who I think is one of the great minds on our side. And Bill Whittle said, this is perhaps the most important book he's read in the last 10 years. That's the kind of reviews this book is getting from people who are in the know, who read these things, constantly, because that's their job. Perhaps the most important book I've read in the last 10 years, The Kindergarten of Eden, How the Modern Liberal Thinks.
Yes, and we put up a link on the show page and in the chat room. It's evansayette.com. So, Evan, I want to say good night and goodbye, and thank you so very much.
Thank you.
And maybe you'll have me speak at a Tea Party event one of these days.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And thank you, guys.
Okay.
Wow, what an awesome guest.
Yes.
Oh, man.
And
the Ann Coulter book. What a dirty dog. Perfect. I love that.
All right. We've got 20 seconds left. Just want to remind everyone, come back on Tuesday. Tuesday, we're going to have a fantastic rock group called Madison Rising. And they've got a version of the Star Spangled Banner that'll knock your socks off. It's an all-patriotic group. They do all songs that are only patriotic to America. So we're going to have fun with that one. So until Tuesday, I want to remind everyone to be safe, be happy, and we'll see you next week, and God bless.
Bye, everyone.
If you find yourself in trouble, count on me, my friend. I'll get right up and try. troubled
You've
face.
Been listening to Southern Sense Blog Talk Radio. Producer and your hostess extraordinaire is Ann Ubelis. The theme music, American Stand Up, is written and performed by Don Fortney. For more from Don, check out his webpage, teapartymusic.web.com. Southern Sense is a proud member of Ghost Fighter Radio and Freedom Media Network. Southern Sense is common sense. Take it out, Don.
American.